I was set to preach any of the sermons and lead the services that I lead, traveling on the road, and then engaging with a small group of y'all, there came the request, could you talk about someone who inspires you? We are spending this summer exploring people who inspire us. The request was made in earnestness, and I found y'all quite endearing, so I said yes, and then I thought, wait. People who inspire us. It's been a tough summer on the inspiration front, and I sat down to write and came back to Carrie and said, you know, this is actually turning out to be more about what happens when the people who have inspired us can't do that anymore. And she said, bring it, we need that word. So here you go. There is a weird thing that's been happening for my family this summer. Couples that we have known, gay, straight, people we've been friends with forever, the kinds of families who inspire my own are family role models and cheerleaders, and you need those at all stages of life. They're announcing that they're splitting up. After hearing this again and again, I've wondered if it's real. It feels remarkable. Like a tidal wave of we've decided to divorce. And I'm just looking at empirical data in my own life, but I do think that sometimes this happens. There's a season of splitting up. There were in our lives the people who divorced just a few years after marrying, the ones you assume are folks who realize maybe they should not have married each other in the first place. And then 7 or 8 years ago in our lives, there was another wave which felt closer to home. I would call that one the transition to parenthood, and the early years of juggling it all are really freaking hard. And amid all of this, there is a constant recognition. My partner and I know it, as all couples, married or not, do, that no one knows the truth of any relationship who isn't part of it. There is just no telling. But even so, this thing happening with our friends seems like a different thing. At this point in our lives, I've been partnered with my husband for 20 years. We've been in it long enough to have ridden through rough times and returned to happy times and know who we are as families. And yet, I'm watching it fall apart for people who inspire us. And it's not just mystification that I'm feeling. It's also grief. What does it mean when something that has been good, at least in large part, a fulfilling, fruitful, long partnership, what does it mean that it's ending in a voluntary parting of ways? What do we say about the tearing apart of something out of which beautiful things have arisen? Things that no one involved, however they feel now, would choose to take back. It is deeply sad to watch partnership end. And under the sadness, I personally also feel fear. Like this thing that keeps happening with our friends, is it coming for us? I keep looking at my partner and saying we would know, right? Right? I was musing about all of this with a friend recently, the whole thing. I wondered what was up and if there are ways for friends or for church or for whatever collective we that we have available, if there's a way for us to support families, to support partnership better. If there are ways for us to be the inspiration, or at least the hope together, knowing that sometimes we each lose our own. What my friend said to me is, oh, this one, this wave that you're talking about, this one is the midlife crisis. I laughed. My friend is a generation older than I am, and I suppose it's funny to discover that I have aged into a thing that always felt like it was made to refer to my parents. And my friend said, no, seriously, the late 30s and 40s struggle is a push for authenticity. It's a need to live in a way that feels real, and people don't know what is wrong or how to name what they want in the midst of that wrestling. It's like a fog descends. The truth is that in the midst of it, you can't see the end of your nose. Have you felt a fog descend? It happens sometimes. My own authenticity-driven insanity, and it is so important not to trivialize mental illness, so let me clarify that I really did think I was having a psychotic break. This is when I first started seeing a therapist. Like, no, really, this is an emergency. For the first time, and I continued for the entire 5-year adventure that followed, my adventure was called, I Think I Have a Call to the Ministry. I am lucky that my primary relationship survived this, and not able to see the end of my nose pretty much sums that up. In the end, my family and I have invested tens of thousands of dollars, lived apart for 10 to 12 weeks over 3 years, reversed parenting roles, had some super hard conversations, and some really terrible arguments, and then moved 1,500 miles away from any home we knew in the service of this thing. I hope that we are done with existential fog in my household for a couple of decades. But this fog, this thing that descends and obscures what used to be clear while we grope our way individually or together toward an unseen future, this place where we can't see and we try not to step on each other in the process of moving forward. Let's talk about this thing, because I have a hunch that it affects not just marriages, but communities. Where have you experienced fog? I think some of this is inevitable. We get confused about who we are, ourselves and together in partnership with one another. We get confused as a side effect of growth. What we choose to do when the fog descends is optional. But the truth, and it is a hard truth, is that sometimes only after all the confusion has cleared and the dust has settled, it's only then that we understand that our flailing, desperate movements or our urge to cut the ties to what has held us, that those have hurt things that we loved. Sometimes we don't know because we cannot know until it is too late. As Maya Angelou said, do the best you can until you know better. I get fog. And I also get that every relationship is its own microcosm, its own set of possibilities and impossibilities, its own story. I know personally that every mid-length marital partnership is a strung together series of yeses, and also some maybes and a few I'm not so sure's, as much as it is one initial moment of promising. And this is true of every arc that means something in our lives, a career, a friendship, a lifespan. We are defined so often by the labels that get conferred in those particular heady moments when we publicly say the yes, but we spend all the times in between either working toward or living into those moments of high promise that we make. The promises are what is visible, the score of the work behind those promises, both physical and emotional, is kept by our own bodies, by our own hearts, in moment after moment that take place outside of the public eye. But when people are marrying, they are not just promising, right? A marriage is a covenant, like so many of the things we do here in church. Covenanting means we accept and bring ourselves before the biggest and most sacred things that we know. We bring ourselves before that which we agree to hold holy. When we covenant, we affirm that even when promises are broken, we are still held by something more. And the truth is that those kinds of promises can never be held by individuals alone. I want to pause here for clarity. Marriage is what I am wrestling with in my own life. It comes to hand easily as an example, but what I want to talk about here is not marriage. Not really. I also want to say that divorce is sometimes the best option for all involved. To acknowledge that divorce or separation may have saved your sanity, or your finances, or your life. You do what you have to do. Our faith says clearly you are not required to destroy yourself for the happiness or even for the well-being of another. You are not required to destroy yourself. What I am saying is that while you are in the struggle of trying to keep your covenants, and especially in those times when it truly feels like a struggle, you are not alone. You did not covenant alone. This is why we have witnesses to every marriage ceremony, not merely in church, but when there is a justice of the peace. It's not that we are concerned that that person can't be held to their word. It's because we know at an elemental societal level, covenants happen in community. We are held in relationship with one another in these highest promises, with these values and commitments that we hold highest in our lives. We have partners around us inspiring us to do the things we said we would. So what to do? What to do when the inspiration just isn't there? When those who we had thought we could count on to inspire us fall woefully short? When the fog descends and we find ourselves helpless? Sufi poet Rumi says, keep working. Keep working, keep digging your well. Submit to a daily practice. Keep knocking, knowing that eventually the joy inside will open a window. Daily practice that can look like being calm with ourselves. It can look like keeping our words and our behaviors in bounds of covenant in our communities, even when it's difficult. It can look like breathing deeply and counting from 10 before speaking. These are the behaviors of a community in practice. And practice goes farther than just what we do with our bodies, right? We are called not just to actions, but to attitudes. We are called to a set of beliefs, and I do not mean the content of a creed. I mean we are called to the faith of belief in one another. This is a piece of what I think was imagined in that line, "Assume good intentions," that has found its way into so many Unitarian Universalist covenants. We are beginning together to question that phrase itself, to understand that a focus on intent can shield the reality of impact. It can block the need for accountability. That work will continue, and the call to faith, the call to a continued yes to what we have already chosen, it continues to exist around it. We are called, whatever words we use, to continue to believe in what we can be together. A promise is a yes now to be acted out in the future. A covenant is a yes to the future, to be acted out, to be worked at and practiced in the spaces where things are hard. And to have that future, we have to keep faith even with our thoughts. We have to commit to the work, to the practice, even with where we put our hearts and our heads. It's not just about our hands. And here's a secret that no one tells you. The holy work, the daily challenge, it continues even after the promises we have made and known are effectively severed. Those of you who have divorced, was that moment the end of having to figure out any relationship with your former spouse whatsoever? Just magically gone, right? Yeah. If we've loved someone who has died, was even that moment the end of relating, of figuring things out, including with that person? It's amazing and mystifying, and sometimes I have to do some pastoral care for grieving humanists around this. What's happening? But it's real. That relationship, that work, it continues. We are in the work of every relationship we have, every relationship we have ever had until the time that we ourselves die. This is why marital counselors advise us, if you feel tempted flirting with another person, think about paying bills with them. This may occur to us as the verbal equivalent of a cold shower, but that's not actually where the magic of the suggestion lies. It's in calling us toward noting the work of covenant, that whoever we are doing that with, it remains work. Keep working. As communities, as fellow travelers, we can help one another in that process. I am from Wyoming. I grew up rock climbing. I am not a technical expert. It's merely a hobby and a family connection for me. But I think about ministry a lot while I'm climbing. There are lessons for us in the heights. In technical climbing, you can't just scramble up the rocks willy-nilly. You would be putting yourself and others below you in danger. You need gear and good support if you're going to survive the experience, much less make it to the top. Of all of the ways of doing technical rock climbing, red pointing is one of the hardest. It means free climbing a route with a lead rope instead of a fixed rope at the top anchored. You carry your rope with you. You attach to the anchors that you make. You actually drill them into the rock as you go. We red point things all our lives, right? We bear the hazards. We learn the paths. We teach ourselves along the way what is steady and what isn't. But red pointing isn't the only way to climb. There is also pink pointing. That's when you lead climb, you're still bringing your own rope, but you have the protection of pre-placed anchors. You have carabiners on a path that someone before you has laid. Someone before you has marked out the way, left things to clip into, supports. We are always supported, set up for success by those who have charted a path before. And where we can, we also give each other room to take a break from being the lead climber or the lead flyer, a break from inspiring us, a place to rest. Geese fly in formation with a clear leader, but they have a system. Do you know this? They have a system for allowing gracefully their leader to drop back and rest and for others to move forward. Without leaving the air, they find ways to carry one another. And if one ever does have to leave the air, a couple of others go with them. Geese know a lot about living in covenant. We do this in our communities as well, or we can. I am a Unitarian Universalist minister, but I am also ELCA Lutheran. I call myself a Unituthuran Universalist. And in Lutheran Church, we have a liturgy that we say together that is basically the same every single week. It's at the very start of the church service. It begins, and I know this is a tough concept for you use, bear with me. It begins with a shared confession of sins, the Kyrie. When we say that we use we as the pronoun, we say we have sinned against one another by what we have done and by what we have left undone. In thought, word, in deed, we have not loved God with our whole hearts. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We say this with one voice using we because week to week to week we carry one another in these words. Sometimes parts of it are not for us, but I assure you they are always for someone. We fly in formation so that everyone has the support that they need Sunday to Sunday. Here in our UU communities, My pledge as a faith leader is this. I'm cheering for you. I'm cheering for your full growth and development. I'm cheering for your constant connection to community. I'm cheering for your being a recipient of and a faithful witness to the largest love we know. I'm cheering for us to be people who show up. I'm cheering for your congregation, even if this is the only time we ever meet. And until the moment that you tell me it's over, I am cheering for your partnership, for your marriage, for your covenants. I am cheering for us to keep choosing what we have chosen, and I am here for the wrestling of how to do that, stage by stage. A truth, and I know you know, a truth is that sometimes disappointment means drawing lines. Sometimes heartbreak means taking cover for a bit. And sometimes, amid the heartbreak and disappointment and tears of realizing that those who have inspired us on a journey thus far cannot continue, sometimes it means realizing that we ourselves, in the manner of baby trees after a forest fire. We were just at Yellowstone a couple weeks ago. Realizing that we ourselves now have some space to grow into the people that we have been waiting for. That after the fog lifts and we take stock, we have the chance to become again the community that we have been waiting for. And together, to messily go forward. Stories run forward, even after chapters that are different than we would have hoped. New connections are made. New characters are introduced. New doors and windows open. New directions are explored. Reverend Liz, your last settled minister, she is now my closest colleague geographically. She is my mentor in a settlement that has been isolating and at times challenging. It's true. And even so, I am not here before you as part of some carefully orchestrated plan. I was down on staff at SUSE last week. I messaged 5 congregations in the DC area a couple months ago, and you were the first to say yes. And it's like this. It's like this that we are all connected. It's like this that we are all part of what inspires the love of this moment. Sometimes the threads between us are tangible and able to be seen with the eye. Able to be named with clear labels. And sometimes, more often but not less important, the ties that bind us together are invisible. Invisible threads of faith and trust, energy that we ourselves have been part of, going off to do love in the world. Maya Angelou. Maya Angelou said, "Do the best you can," but that isn't the whole quote. What she actually said is, "Do the best you can until you know better. Then do better." May your red pointing and pink pointing be safe enough and abundantly fruitful. Amen. In love. I invite you.